So would you describe this as like the golden period of medical education or medical
at that time?
Idealism, yeah. There was this sincerity.
I guess, you know, it probably comes in cycles. And, you know, I'm sure there were other cycles early on. But certainly, yeah, that was, I think that was a very good period. I think, you know, a lot of the, you've heard of the Yellow Berets.
Right.
I mean, you know, I think in terms of the biomedical research right now, if it weren't for the Yellow Berets, I'm not sure if it would be as the quality of the American biomedical research would be as good right now if it weren't for them. And I was really influenced by the war, you know, that these people decided, you know, they made a choice. They didn't want to go to war. They wanted to serve in the public health service, NIH, and they went. And, you know, some of the major players, you know, went through that period. And CDC, too. I mean, most of the people, you know, when I went to CDC, my bosses were all people who went through that period, and they wanted to go to CDC because they wanted to avoid the war, and you know, they're the ones who sort of directed it, and that's why CDC is the way it is. I think, you know, their whole attitude towards public health is influenced by those people, and so, you know, it was a good period, and, you know, unfortunately that didn't get sustained. What's refreshing and reassuring, I guess, is that no matter, you know, what year of medical school students you talk to, there's always a few, two or three, that still, I think, have those idealism. And, you know, that was one really good thing about Cornell, that every year some student would come to me, and I wanted to work and go to Brazil and work on some of our projects. And they were probably the best students, you know, of the class. They're usually very exceptional students. And so it hasn't gone away completely. You know, there's still, I think, people like that. I don't know where they come from. I don't know why they do. You know, none of them just have the kind of background that I've had. You know, they're growing up in New York City or, you know, Midwest someplace. Warren Johnson, you know, is someone who grew up in the Midwest and, you know, did his medical school at Columbia, mm-hmm. and, you know, his residency in Cornell, and he stayed in New York City, and he's the one who started this whole program in Brazil, and, you know, has a big program in Haiti, mm-hmm. and he's been doing this for more than 20 years, and, you know, why? So the background has nothing to do with it, I think. You know, you make that choice at some point to do that.
Okay. So what is it? You know,
I don't know. I don't know what it is.
Okay. Well, after spending a couple of years, you know, in the kind of the rote coursework that one mm-hmm. used to go through medical school, and then going to Thailand and mm-hmm. Getting clinical experience mm-hmm. in, say, the field,
mm-hmm.
How did your attitudes change towards the role of medicine and the individual medical officer or physician mm-hmm. with regards to developing countries? What the role of medicine could be
as a practicing physician?
Yeah, as a practicing mm-hmm. physician. And the responsibility of medicine in general
mm-hmm.
to kind of mm-hmm. The kind of global community.
Mm. Well, I guess during my, you know, 3-month elective time in Thailand, I think I gradually began to realize that that it's not enough just to be a physician, practicing physician in those settings. In fact, it was not very efficient. The problem is so overwhelming that I guess I began to feel that a single person is not going to be able to make that much of a difference. It'd be like a drop in the bucket in the ocean. So there had to be some other ways. And, you know, I had to see that to come to that recognition, the realization. And, you know, that's when I really began to feel that you have to look at this from a bigger picture, and you know, from a point of view of public health. And the negative side, you know, that is that you don't get the immediate sort of more direct physician to patient interaction. You have to sort of remove yourself from that and then look at the problem that contributes to these individuals becoming ill in a community. And it takes a much longer time to identify those factors that contribute to the illnesses. But once you identify these factors, then you can make a big impact. You know, you can influence hundreds of people at once just by identifying a particular risk factor for an illness or coming up with a new way to detect a pathogen very rapidly. But you just don't see the patients individually. So that's a sacrifice that you make. But if you are seeing individual patients, then maybe you're making a difference in one or two people a day. In your lifetime, you know, how many is that? It's not very many.
And that was a result of your experience.
Yeah, my experience. Yeah. I remember one patient that I had was an elderly man. He had chronic obstructive lung disease. And it was just the difference in I guess the culture. You see a patient, in San Francisco General Hospital, the attitude, I guess, of the way people see illness, their own illness, and then the relationship to, I guess, the practicing physicians, is something that I didn't realize until I was in Thailand. So this elderly man, I would see him every morning, and would make recommendations for certain medicines that he needed to take. Every morning I would come in, he would not take the medicines. And one morning he was, he was dead. But he left a note for me. It was a note and apologizing for not taking the drugs, but he just didn't want to do it. And it just sort of makes you realize, why did he have to apologize? You just sort of realize that this kind of patient-physician relationship, for me, it was very difficult, there's nothing I could do to make this person take this medicine in that setting, and that was what kept him alive. I didn't want to encounter those kind of situations over and over. And, I wanted to do something that would prevent that sort of thing from taking place, to begin with. There are many examples. Thailand, when my rotation in Thailand was the first time I saw, somebody dead, a patient. Happened, not this man, but even earlier, it was a young woman came into the intensive care unit. And, you sort of realize how completely different a dead person looks. Because that person was, alive the previous day, and I couldn't recognize this person. And, I guess as a medical student, you sort of discover those things. I mean, it was going through a discovery period. But, but there's a lot of intense, moments, I think, when you have to deal with individuals. Even later on, when I was a resident. No, I was a fellow, actually, at Stanford, after even having been at CDC. When I first started CDC, it was 1981. That's when AIDS cases were becoming recognized, and you know the term AIDS hadn't even been coined yet. But through the 3 years at CDC, all I heard about AIDS was just numbers, you know, statistics. I never actually saw an AIDS patient until I started my fellowship at Stanford. And one of my first patients that I saw at Stanford who had AIDS was a man who was dying, and he decided he wanted to die at home. And so that afternoon when we saw him, as I was leaving the room, I didn't know what to say. Do you say goodbye? I'll see you later. You know you're not going to see him later. You know, I was just completely at a loss to say the appropriate words to leave that room from that patient. And again, you know, these are the kind of things that...
what did you end up saying?
I can't remember. It was very... You know, it was obviously awkward. And, you know, he died that evening at home. So that's why I wanted to go to public health.
So that, why was it that you wanted to go in public health? So that you wouldn't have these intense one-to-one physician...
Yeah, those were difficult. And and at the same time, you know, I didn't think I was being very efficient in being able to be, or not efficient, maybe, you know, effective.
Mm-hmm. And with this man with this chronic obstructive pulmonary disease,
mm-hmm.
When you reacted to his, where did you see, what was the basis of the reaction that you were where was your responsibility in that you should have seen to it that he takes his
mm-hmm.
medicine,
mm-hmm.
or that you felt strange that he apologized to you in this note that he didn't take?
It was both.
Okay.
I mean, it was a combination of guilt, and maybe not having pushed enough. But then that was an American thing to do.
Okay.
You know, I didn't know what a Thai physician would have done in that setting. And then just getting this note, it's attached to a little a little flower, as it was given to me by a family member. Yeah, no, I didn't know how to react to it.
Yeah. And did your background in philosophy and Eastern philosophy
nothing.
Okay. So, in terms of your philosophical background, you weren't any bit prepared.
No.
Okay. And you brought up AIDS, and I wanted to ask. Going to medical school in San Francisco in the late '70s was in. Kind of community health, was there any sense at that time that something larger was going on in the
No, there's no idea.
Community?
No, I mean, in terms of AIDS?
In terms of AIDS,
no.
That anybody was making any observations?
No, nothing. I didn't, learn about that towards even senior year in my residency, third year in residency.
Yeah.
Okay. It was one of those cases in Los Angeles got reported. So, there was no idea.
And then how did you decide on your clinical specialty and where you would do your intern and residency?
I wanted to be in New York City and,
okay.
Close
right.
to my girlfriend. and in New York City, the only place I applied to was Columbia. I didn't apply to Einstein. Einstein was medical school.
Yeah.
Just Columbia. And then I applied to Johns Hopkins and Yale. And I got into Columbia.
Okay. And what was your intent in pursuing what you were going to accomplish during your intern and residency?
Oh, just finish my internal medicine residency and then
become licensed and a practicing clinician. Or
No. Use that as a stepping stone to do international health.
Okay.
Either as I mentioned, either go to the London School, but then. Towards, the end of my internship, I learned about CDC, the CDC program.
Yeah.
There was a good friend of mine, a very close friend, in my class of internship, Jeff Harris. He was much more informed about the CDC, so we talked, and then we both applied, and we both got into the same branch at CDC.
Okay.
And then, so, you know, he and I had reinforced each other to go to CDC. And,
yeah.
So yeah, no, that was the plan. It was either that or you know, infectious disease fellowship afterwards. So I had all the applications, you know, sort of completed, ready to go out in case I didn't get it to CDC. So, but you know, when I heard, I just threw them out.
Yeah.
It's probably the best decision I've made in my life.
Really?
To go to CDC. Mm-hmm.
Why? Yeah.
No, it's just sort of affirmed everything I wanted to do. And, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier about trying to incorporate all my previous trainings and putting that together at CDC and being able to really do, you know, what I wanted to do. And, you know, the people there, too, were all, at least in my class, you know, were also people with very similar interests. You know, the people who go to CDC are people who don't know what to do with their life. And so they go there for a few years and, you know, to discover what they want
to
do.
Would that apply to you?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't know what you wanted to do with your life?
Yeah. In the long term, yeah, I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, there are many, people in my class who did the IRC, you know, in Thailand, you know, working in the refugee camps, and you know, there are others who, you know, did other things. There are others who, you know, were like me, just straight out of their residency, and so it was a really nice group. And, you know, at the same time, you know, you learn how to do epidemiology. I was in the enteric diseases branch, and so, should I start talking about CDC now? Or
sure. I have one question I wanted uh-huh. to ask before we move on is, how
mm-hmm.
did you perceive the differences between, say, practicing medicine in Thailand
mm.
and a developing country
mm.
versus your internship and residency experience
mm.
in an urban
mm.
center like New York City and
mm-hmm.
the kinds of diseases that you would find, the differences between the two?
Mm. Yeah, no, working in New York City was a real eye-opener for me. I guess, yeah, even more than the San Francisco General Hospital. You know, San Francisco General, you know, is an inner-city county hospital.
Yeah.
So you saw the kind of things you see in county hospital, you know, a lot of drug-related or, you know, violence-related cases, you know, coming into the emergency room. My very first rotation at Columbia was in the emergency room, and it was, you know, it was in the summer. So I saw all kinds of things coming in, and it was much more intense than it was in San Francisco General Hospital. You know, you sort of learn about different types of patients. You know, Columbia, many large teaching hospitals, you have sort of the private side where you see, you know, people from one segment of society, very different sort of diseases, and then the other side, which are the the inner city populations. And most of the time, you know, you spend taking care of the latter group, and that's when you learn, and you know, you sort of learn medicine by taking care of the indigent population, about their medicines, and that's where most of the learning, you know, takes place. And that was very similar to, you know, what I experienced in Thailand. That, you know, you sort of learn by taking care of, you know, people who are not able to provide for themselves in terms of the healthcare. There were some similarities, but then the intensity was really, you know, what you see as a resident is, you know, very frustrating. Is a lot of things you see are, you know, more sort of about life style-oriented things.
Okay.
You know, you see things because of overabundance. Whereas in Thailand, you see things because of lack of, you know, resources and lack of food, I mean, lack of, you know. Whereas even in the inner cities in the U.S., you know, you see disease because of, you know, overeating, you know, obesity related, diabetes, you know, hypertension. These are all overeating related, or over-smoking, you know, over-drinking, you know. These are all lifestyle-related things. You know, 80% of the things you see are things related to overabundance, availability of these things. And, you know, you learn a lot, but you also get turned off by the whole thing, especially when having worked in Thailand, you know. You see diseases, but you know they're different for different reasons. So that's when I became interested more and more in infectious diseases. Infectious disease, at least, it's not your fault, right? I mean, you know, nature does it to you. I got more and more turned off by certain subspecialty.
Yeah. And were you making these observations that there were these new epidemics like AIDS, but also a resurgence of things we thought we had under control, like tuberculosis?
Well, actually, TB was at its lowest during the whole period of my residency. Right. In fact, 1981, New York City had the lowest incidence of TB in the history. So that's when I finished my residency. It wasn't coming up at the time. It was really after I had left that TB really started taking off in New York.
Yeah. So. Okay. And going to the CDC, was this a specialized program, a defined period kind of program?
Right. It was called the Epidemiologic Intelligence Service. And they, you know, take in maybe 50 to 60 people each year. For a two-year program, where they, you know, they go through sort of on-the-job training in epidemiology, you know, doing outbreak investigations. There are many branches. You know, mine was in enterics, but there are also non-infectious disease, you know, branches, reproductive health branch. There's an International Health Program Office where, you know, which dealt more with program, you know, evaluation of health programs, you know, abroad. And there was a parasitology, you know, branch where you know, dealt with tropical diseases. But when I was going through the initial application process, I became more drawn towards enteric diseases because of the opportunity for outbreak investigations, and that's what I wanted to do. You know, even though I was interested in international health, the problem with that particular branch was that, you know, you end up going abroad for program evaluations. And so you didn't have an opportunity to really learn the didactics of epidemiology. And I wanted to learn, you know, the didactics and practical epidemiology. So I ended up in Turks.
And you could choose then the branch that you wanted to
go through a matching procedure. So what you do is in April there's a week. It's called the EIS week, where the second year, you know, people present their work, and then at the end of that week, Saturday and Sunday, you go through these intense 15-minute interviews with all these people, the branches that you're interested in, you know, possibly applying to. And on Monday, they do a match. So the branch makes a list of their choices, and you make a list of your choices, and you match. So I matched, you know, the one that I wanted to get into, and so.
Was there any other branches that you
parasitology, wanted? It was my second choice. And then the International Healthcare Program Office was my third, I think. You also had an opportunity to go to the states, work in the state health departments.
Okay.
So some people did that, or either that or stay in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And it's a two-year program, but at that time they also started this thing called the Preventive Medicine Residency program. So you had an option to stay the third year to get board eligible for that, and so I did that. So I was there for 3 years.
Okay. And what kind of program was it in terms of, you know, clinical experience?
No, and it's all epidemiology, a lot of field work. I mean, I can give you an example of what I did. So 2 months into my... So the first month, you know, you go through this three-week course, which is sort of an intense course on epidemiology, biostatistics. And, you know, it was a lot of fun because they actually used real outbreak investigations or investigations that have been done to teach as opposed to the kind of things I learned in medical school. Mm. And then you sort of wait. And then you get assigned particular sort of ongoing tasks in the branch. So I became responsible for the salmonella surveillance, you know, for the U.S. And you go through these surveillance forms and, you know, look to see if there's any outbreaks going on. So I think it was August when I got sent on my first outbreak in Philadelphia, you know, eye hospital of salmonellosis. And you go with a second-year student and investigate where the source of the outbreak was. And, you know, we found the source, and you do a case-control study, how to do a case-control, you know, learn how to do a case-control study, and how to collect specimens for, you know, lab processing. And so it's really on-the-job training. It's a really, you know, it's like being in the emergency room, except that you're in an outbreak setting. And we found that it was, you know, associated with pre-cooked roast beef, and so we had to go to the this food processing center in downtown Philadelphia, and we had to, you know, recall the meat, make arrangements for the meat to be recalled. And so you really learn about public health and about how USDA works, and, you know, and how USDA doesn't work sometimes. And but what was interesting at that time was that there was a person named Mitch Cohen who had just returned from Seattle. He was previously at CDC, and he went to do his fellowship training with Stan Falkel, who was at in Seattle at the time, and came back and introduced a lot of these molecular techniques to do epidemiology. And so he was the first one to sort of bring in the technology of, you know, fingerprinting enteric pathogens like Salmonella, and we're like the first EIS officers to really start playing with that. And so I was actually, that's when I first started working in the lab.
Okay.
So I would go down to the basement and extract the, you know, plasmids from salmonella strains and do electrophoresis analysis and then look at the patterns. And when this outbreak happened, you know, one of the questions that came up was, okay, you know, this pre-cooked roast beef was all over the community, New Jersey and in Pennsylvania. And there were a lot of salmonella, the serotype was Salmonella Newport. So the question that came up was, okay, we knew what the vehicle was and we knew what caused the outbreak in these specific, you know, settings like the hospital, and there's another outbreak in a wedding in New Jersey. But there were a lot of sporadic cases, you know, of salmonellosis and sporadic cases of Salmonella Newport. Now, how many of those cases were really due to the pre-cooked roast beef? That question really couldn't be answered by traditional epidemiological methods, even traditional laboratory methods. So we apply the molecular technique, and it turns out 45% of all these sporadic cases have the same pattern as the pattern that we saw from the Salmonella Newport isolate from the meat. So we're able to say for the first time ever that during this period, July through September 1981, that 45% of salmonellosis due to Salmonella Newport in these two states were due to pre-cooked roast beef. And what was even more interesting was that even after we recalled the meat, there were still some cases occurring in the community with this identical plasmid profile infection. So, you know, what was going on when the meat had already been? It turns out the cases who had these after the recall of the meat were siblings or the ones who got sick early. So here, again, we're able to, for the first time, show the dynamics of transmission of this organism. It gets introduced into a community by a food product, but it gets sustained by person-to-person transmission. So there's two modes of infection going on here, two mechanisms. And so this was really the first time when this new technique produced a completely new concept of how a disease is transmitted in a community setting. So it's very easy to identify a source if you have an outbreak. But how do you identify a source in sporadic cases, cases that are not obviously connected to any outbreak? So this was really the first, you know, application and an example of it. So I got more and more interested in that kind of molecular approach to doing epidemiology.
And how much experience did you have with molecular techniques before?
Well, that was nothing. That was my first time. I didn't even know how to hold a pipette.
Oh, wow. At that time, okay, yeah. So how does one go from knowing absolutely
nothing
yeah. to becoming very proficient in 2 or 3 mm-hmm. years at molecular technique?
Well, I mean, you know, the molecular thing is I learned at CDC were very simple. And, you know, it's even CDC yeah. at the time was just beginning to, you know, do those things. And, but I had a, you know, very good technician. I mean, technician who helped me, Chris Berkness, who, you know, worked with me. And, you know, I mean, everything I know from that period, and I learned from her, you know, even just not knowing, you know, discovering that you're not supposed to put salmonella in the refrigerator. You know, they get killed. And you know, just real basic stuff. But that's all, you know, essentially I did. And, you know, in extracting plasma and running them in gel. But that was the extent of my understanding of molecular techniques. And that's why I went to Stanford. I wanted to learn more advanced okay. molecular methods. And the reason I chose Stanford is because Stan Falco had already moved from Seattle to Stanford by the time I finished the EIS. And so I wanted to do an infectious disease fellowship there. More, not so much to do the fellowship, but to learn molecular techniques.
And at the time you were at CDC, how aware of you were you and your colleagues of introducing kind of a new epidemiological paradigm of the molecular epidemiology?
It was completely new.
Yeah.
Nobody else was doing it. You know, we were the ones who really setting the territory, I mean, the definitions. You know, how do you apply it? Even Mitch Cohen, you know, he introduced the technique, but nobody knew how powerful it was until we actually apply them in real outbreak settings. That was the, you know, sort of the discovery that these things are empirically determined. You can't just come up with a technique. You know, that's what I tell my students now. You can't just come up with a subtyping technique or strain typing technique. You know, you have to apply it and then see if the technique is useful or not. You don't know a priori whether a technique is useful or not until you apply it in some real world setting. So the second chance that I had to apply this was, you know, I got sent to Brazil in my second year. And in São Paulo, Brazil, which is the largest city in South America, there were all these cases of drug-resistant salmonellosis going on among kids. And, you know, there were salmonella meningitis, 90% mortality. There were no antibiotics that they could use to treat these kids. There's just no way to, you know, do anything for these kids once they had the infection. The only way to do something about this is prevent the infection from occurring in the first place. So how do you do that? You have to know where these infections are coming from. And so we did a case control study, and it turns out about 40% of the salmonellosis cases were salmonella type murium. It's one common serotype. And they were all associated with hospitals. But we didn't know if it was the case that the kids were getting the infection in the hospitals, or that, you know, they came into the hospital for some other reason and then got sent home. And because they received antibiotics in the hospital, they were selecting for drug-resistant salmonella in the community. So what, you couldn't answer those two things, two possibilities. Because it's been well established that when you take antibiotics, you are at risk for getting infection with drug-resistant salmonella. And that usually occurs in the community in the U.S., because you select for those. But in São Paulo, we didn't know. Were they getting the infection in the hospital, or were they getting it in the community? That was the problem that we had to solve. So we applied the molecular techniques and did the fingerprint analysis, and when you actually look at all these salmonella type murium strains by profiles, they clustered in time. And each cluster was associated with a particular hospital in the city. So every particular cluster pattern came from one single hospital. And so we're able to say that up to 50% of salmonella type murium infections in São Paulo are coming from specific hospitals in the city. So they were able to go to those hospitals and say, look, you know, something is going on in the hospital setting, and these kids are getting the infections in the hospitals, you have to do something about it. So we're able to make a very specific recommendation based on the molecular, you know, information. And if we can reduce the problem by 50%, you know, that was better than anything that anybody could come up with, you know. So this is what I mean. I didn't see the individual kids who were getting the salmonellosis, But after a long period of time, where to make a very specific economic pinch, that was going to make a real difference in a lot of kids. And so that was sort of the second really powerful example of how this new technology could contribute to, you know, public health problems. And there are many other, you know, things we've done since then. So.
And what was your statistical expertise?
You learn during that during the whole 2 years, and you know, there was a very good statistical backup. And whenever you had questions, you just go up to them and you learn. And you learn the basic things, and those stay with you. When it comes to more advanced things, you at least learn, you know, where to go for help. And you know, these days there's so many computer programs that you can use, and if you to you know, go through the EIS, you sort of know what sort of programs you need, and do it yourself or talk to somebody. You know, even in Berkeley, there's a lot of people here who can help you. So, but it's a real skill that, you know, that you develop, and, you know, in addition to just the lab skills, you know, being able to design case control studies and, you know, just study designs and manipulate data and, you know, data management. So, that's essentially the training of the EIS. And my but the my claim to fame in the EIS was the identification of this E. coli L157H7. That was my second outbreak investigation that I did. It was in Oregon. It was bloody diarrhea cases. Nobody knew what was going on, and I spent about a month investigating in this little tiny town in southern Oregon. We didn't know after the first outbreak what the cause was, but we knew that it was associated with eating hamburgers in a fast food restaurant there. And then 3 months later, another same outbreak occurs in Michigan. And the second time, we're able to get to the lot of meat that was implicated in the outbreak, and we were able to isolate the C. coli from the meat, so that was the sort of the smoking gun, and we were able to say for the first time that this particular serotype of E. coli was the cause of hemorrhagic colitis. And now you hear it all over the, you know, country. Now it's really
Big Mac attack.
Yeah, Big Mac attack. Well, Jack in the Box they had.
Yeah.
Well, the apple juice, you know,
right.
Old water last year. The big recall of the meat just a couple months ago. So it's becoming a major pathogen, an emerging pathogen, but it was, I did the very first outbreak investigation on that one, and, it was a very interesting time, because, just the process of going through identifying a new pathogen, for a new disease entity, you know, it was very exciting.
And how aware were you before you came up with your results that this would be your claim to fame? What was your hypothesis as to...
You know, it wasn't just me. I mean, you know, I did the investigation, but the
right.
laboratory people really had to work hard to isolate the E. coli.
Yeah. I mean, what did you think was going on before?
I was first sent to the outbreak, you know, we had no idea that this was even an infectious disease process.
Okay.
It could have been, some sort of chemical toxin.
Okay.
Could have been, it could have been anything. And it wasn't until we started doing the field work. I was helped by Steve Helgerson, who was from Oregon, Health Department, and came down, Washington. And then, we did several case control studies, and we narrowed it down to this one food establishment, McDonald's. But we couldn't really initially narrow it down to a particular food item. We knew that it was hamburgers, but we didn't know if it was the bread or the onions or the little sauce they put on or the hamburger meat itself.
Yeah.
And so when I went back to CDC with all the specimens and stool samples, we had the E. coli 1x7, but we didn't believe it at that time that E. coli could cause this kind of disease, because at that time there were only three classes of E. coli associated with diarrhea. The enterotoxic E. coli, enter-invasive E. coli, and enter-pathogenic E. coli. Only enter-invasive E. coli cause bloody diarrhea, but not this kind of bloody diarrhea.
Mm-hmm.
And enter-invasive E. coli also caused fever. In this particular bloody diarrhea, fever was minimal. or non-existent. It was just didn't fit anything. I mean, we just couldn't believe that E. coli could do this. So we sort of kept that in the back burner. And then when the same serotype was identified in the Michigan outbreak, then we became really suspicious. Because when we looked at the collection of E. coli at CDC, you know, that goes back to the 40s, there was only one strain of that particular serotype. It was 1975. It was sent to CDC from California in 1975. So I tried to track down this patient from which the E. coli was obtained. It turns out she was in the Naval Center or what?
In Monterey?
No, the Alameda.
Oh, okay.
Alameda Naval
Air Base.
Yeah, yeah. Base, yeah. So she had already retired or something. It was no longer there. But the medical chart, I tried to locate the medical chart. It had already been sent to storage somewhere in Kansas. The Navy has a storage someplace in the Midwest. But, you know, about a month later, this huge stack of mail arrives in my desk, and I open it. It's the medical chart. And I read through the chart, and it describes the illness that was identical to the kind of illness that I saw in Oregon. I said, this must be the organism, the cause of the organism. It was a young woman who had bloody diarrhea with no fever. And so there were a lot of these things that were beginning to fit together. And then when we isolated the same E. coli from the meat sample, then we nailed it. But there were still a lot of skeptics, you know, at the time that E. coli could do this. So I had to design another study, a prospective study. I set up a national surveillance and asked all the physicians, mostly gastroenterologists, if they saw bloody diarrhea cases, you know, culture them for the usual pathogens, but also send us the E. coli that they isolated. And it turns out over 30% of those E. coli that were sent to us were E. coli 0.5-7-H7. And at that time, that was a rare serotype. So to see 35-30-some%, you know, really was significant, and so that was sort of the second sort of evidence that this was the cause of hemorrhagic colitis. And then since then, you know, there's been so many outbreaks that was no longer an issue. But one of the interesting things you sort of discover, you know, about science is when you first describe something that's sort of counter to everything else that's been known, there's a lot of reluctance in a lot of really well-established scientists to accept those things.
And why is that?
I don't know. I think it's just the human nature. You know, I've discovered that many, many times after that, too, and other things that I've done. But just the intensity of disbelief, you know, when I presented the findings in, like, an ASM or, you know, meetings, you know, people will come up to you and they'll say, you know, in your face that they don't believe it. And so those same people who are, you know, said those things are now, you know, working with the same E. coli, you know, making their living working on the E. coli. So it's interesting how this happens. But I think that's quite true with any profession, you know. There's always this kind of attitude. But, you know, it took, I guess, several months before I was convinced myself that it was the E. coli. You know, went through a lot of other hypotheses beforehand. You know, other organisms were considered, but then dropped. You know.
Okay. Let me put in a new tape.
Okay.